Please turn to Revelation chapter 21. It would be helpful if someone could bring me water, either in the form of a bottle or a glass. Thank you. Appreciate it. And our text begins with verse 15, but I will begin in verse 9, covering the text that we studied last week as well. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and walls. The city lies foursquare, its length the same as its width. And he measured the city with his rod, 12,000 stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. He also measured its wall, 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement. The wall was built of jasper, while the city was pure gold, clear as glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass. Thanks, Ben. The largest city in the world by size, not population, is New York Metro. I was surprised too, but it is New York Metro, and it is by far the largest city by size. This urban area covers 3,353 square miles, which is roughly speaking 58 miles by 58 miles if it was a square. But can you imagine a city of 2 million square miles? Not 3,350, 2 million square miles. Or can you imagine a city of about 1,400 miles by 1,400 miles? Even by today's city size standards, which differ from those of the first century when this text was created, it blows your mind. 1,400 miles in length and width, that's a city larger than the country of India, which is by no means an international dwarf. That's nearly four times the size of the state of Alaska. And Alaska, as the largest U.S. state, dwarfs Texas, which never seems to stop boasting in its greatness. It's more than twice as big as Texas. Any Texans here? Okay, I knew there would be one. But here is sheer madness. Picture this city now, 1,400 miles by 1,400 miles in length and width, also 1,400 miles high. Never mind Mount Everest, which stands at 5.5 miles, a meager 5.5 miles. This city, it would reach far, far, far into outer space. Outer space begins at an altitude of about 60 miles, 62 miles. 1,400 miles! I hope you're not afraid of heights. A city like this could never be built on Earth. You could not support it. You couldn't found it. So big, so heavy. And it explodes all known architectural categories. But this is what you see here. This is what Jesus shows you this morning. A city of preposterous proportions, the New Jerusalem. So the image is before you, and it is meant to smash the limits of your experience, also to challenge your powers of imagination. I can summarize the shock effect of this text, rightly understood, by two slogans: size matters and shape matters too. This text delivers a vision of the measuring of the New Jerusalem. But before you can even begin to understand it, keep in mind what she is, this city. Verse 9 introduces the New Jerusalem with the words, "Let me show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And as we said last week, the repetitive use of the number 12 and its multiples, 12, 12,000, 144, the repetitive use of this number of the fullness of God's people, the number 12, throughout this chapter confirms this is no city, this is a people. This is no city, and these measurements are no architectural blueprint. They're symbolical of God's people, the bride of Christ, the wife of the Lamb. Now, why would Jesus show his bride as a city with these measurements? Now, that's a good question. He shows you the fullness of his people, including you, as a city, because the bride of Christ is the pinnacle of his creative power and wisdom. She is the center of attention next to himself. As the pinnacle and power of God's, the expression of God's power in creation, she is the center of attention among all created beings. And she is, therefore, the way that human beings understand cities. We look at cities, and people used to look at cities, think only of ancient Rome, as the highest expression of human achievement, human community. Cities, they used to be, and they still are, centers of political power, centers of commerce and of culture. And this is why Jesus shows his bride as a city. She is the pinnacle of his creative power and wisdom. She is the seat of the kingdom. And here's another reason, a related reason, why he shows his bride as a city. He shows you his bride as a city because he wants to inhabit her the way people do cities. So, our references to size and shape and materials here, they have something to say about us. You are looking in a mirror. What is Jesus saying about you? Things that are almost too good to be true, but true they are. And obviously, first off, the sheer immensity of the image that is before us carries its main message. Size matters to God. Size matters here, and here in this vision, size translates into a single thought. Important. You are important to God, far more important to God than you can know. The God of the universe has taken a personal interest in you in order to show you what he makes of you, what he thinks of you. He presents you with an image that is so gigantic that it is impossible to get around it. The city bride, enormous in size, tells you what you mean to him. Important, big, meaningful, esteemed, significant, exceptional, foremost, great, large, essential, heavy, principal, weighty. And if there are more words of this semantic group or category, they wouldn't do justice to what this vision says, what God thinks about you. And the thought crystallizes in verses 19 through 21, where the New Jerusalem's gates and foundations and also its wall come into view. Consider only the gates. Each gate, a pearl. 12 gates, 12 pearls. But the size of this city, it's 1,400 miles by 1,400 miles, or 12,000 stadia by 12,000 stadia, 1,400 miles in length and 1,400 miles in width, and then, of course, not to forget, 1,400 miles in height. Apart from the fact that it's almost impossible to picture this city as a cube, have you considered what kind of a pearl it would take to construct a gate, an appropriate gate, that isn't dwarfed by the city itself? I'd like to see the oysters in which those pearls grew. But of course, it's not only the immense size here that carries the message, it's also the incalculable value, which is a very, very related idea, to be sure. It also translates into weightiness, into importance. In Greco-Roman times, a pearl was worth its weight more than its weight in pure gold. The whole picture screams priceless.
Priceless! Priceless! You are of priceless value to God.
And the same, of course, is true for the 12 foundations, these massive foundations. Again, consider the size of this image. And now you have foundations for each of these gates.
And the foundations, they consist of exceedingly, extremely precious stones. Now, the materials that are listed here reveal that God's people possess worth and value far, far beyond all power of human comprehension. Who assigns value? Who determines what's important and what's not important? Who makes the call? This world's value rating, it rides on accomplishments, education, your salary, your job, of course, money, fame, status symbols. And by these standards, in this part of the world, I merely blend into the crowd. I'm nothing. I'm insignificant. And at times I feel like I'm a failure. I feel isolated, down and out. And my life is not what it should be. And the church as a whole, she is fallen, sullied, impure, inconsistent. Don't you all know what this looks like in your homes? Inconsistent and fraught. Fraught.
Who are we that we should be raised to the seat of honor in God's own heart? But you see, that's the point. That's the point. It's God who assigns value and importance. And in this vision, he assures you that you mean the world to him, because this is what the city is. It's the bride of Christ portrayed as a city as large as a world in itself. And God says, you are very important to me. I make much of you. You are the apple of my eye. And I ask you, could it be any different? Jesus Christ, God's own Son, loved you and gave himself up for you. Does this not assign value? Does this mean nothing?
Doesn't this make you very precious? In a sense, you could say that this vision tells you, it reveals what Christ's blood has purchased for him, a perfect bride who shares the stage with himself.
Size matters, but it's not only size that matters, it's the shape of the city too. It's not a square. It appears that way at first sight, but it's not a square. It's a cube. As verse 16 says, length, width, and height are all equal. It's a cube.
Now, in antiquity, the cube was considered the standard of perfection, the perfect shape, the perfect geometric shape, the cube.
But more importantly, it's also a biblical image. The image shows the church of Jesus Christ, including you, as the perfect dwelling place of God. The most holy place in the temple and earlier in the tabernacle was a cube It was the perfect geometric place, and it had to be a perfect place because in that cubic space where width and length and height were all equal, in that cubic space, God's presence was localized. Shape matters. This is a cube. And what does it say of you, the people of God? Simply this: holy, holy, holy. It says holy. The temple and the most holy place, the holiest of holies, it was so holy, it was taboo. It was off limits because no human being possesses the prerequisite holiness to approach the Holy One. So it was off limits. But when God is finished with us, He will make us His most holy place. To fill with His presence of Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul says, it pleased the Father that in Him all the fullness should dwell. Well, this cubic shape, patterned after the most holy place, the holiest of holies, it says, you are holy to me, and I will make my dwelling with you. I will make my fullness dwell within you. I will inhabit you. And it's helpful to realize that the visions of Revelation chapter 21 and 22 summarize and also develop Ezekiel chapter 40, verses 40, or chapter 40 through 48. That is the closing chapters of the prophet Ezekiel. In those closing chapters of Ezekiel, the prophet is shown a city and a temple just as it is here. At a time when the Jerusalem temple had turned into an empty shape, a void. God had left that place. His glory left the temple because of the unfaithfulness of His people and because of her impurity. But in these visions that close out the book, Ezekiel is assured that there would be a day. A day would come when God's presence would dwell with His people again. And in the very last words of these visions, in the very last words of the book of Ezekiel, we read, and the name of the city from that day on shall be the Lord is there. The Lord is there. You will be the most holy, intimate medium. You will be the most holy, intimate place for God to be there, to inhabit. You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy, so that you should be mine. Now, this is one of the most recognizable refrains of the Old Testament. It's an imperative to God's people to be holy. And the New Testament reiterates it. We still need to hear it. 1 Peter 1:15 says, as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. For it is written, be holy, for I am holy. Well, now you know why. He wants a holy people so He can fill us with His presence to be a suitable place of rest for eternity. And as husband and wife become one flesh, Christ and His wife will share holy union forever. Perfect, holy
union. He will dwell in you. And as verse 22 says, though this is for next week, you will dwell in him. You will be a house for the living God, and he will be a house for you. Really? There will be perfect, intimate union because you will possess the prerequisite holiness. Shape matters. You say, oh, I don't feel so holy. My life isn't what it should be, and I feel defeated as a Christian time and again. Well, all the more so. You must listen to this. You must grasp this truth. You are most important, most holy to him. It will be seen one day. And what did you expect? That we should live in this world, going from one victory to the other, only being successful, always on top of our game? What did you expect? That we should live in this world and never see struggle? Never put up a fight? We live for this vision. We inhabit this gospel story. Our life is in God's story. Your life isn't a Wikipedia biography of facts and events, but rather your life story is how you integrate those facts and events into the story that places you in Christ. Your life story doesn't just say what happened to you or happened at this or that time. Your life story is not about events, good events, bad events, or maybe even the worst thing that could happen to your life story is the meaning. It says why it's important. What it means for who you are and for who you will become. Jesus Christ is holding up a mirror in front of you. Look and see, this is your destiny. You are very important to me. I make much of you. You are of incalculable value. You are holy to me, and all things, therefore, work together for your good. An old adage says that everyone has a book inside of him. That's true. What's your story? Does it end like this? Your past and present, or the things that are happening right now, the things that shape your life here and now, they're always interpreted. They ought to be interpreted in light of how the story ends. It is only in this light that they can be seen for what they are. Past and present in your life, therefore, are always up for grabs so long as you remember your destiny. So here you're looking in a mirror. And what you see is what you are to him and what you will become. And what you see ought to do two things. First, it ought to make you want to worship him who brings this to pass. It ought to fill you with wonder and amazement for him, just as size and shape and materials of this vision of this city fill you with wonder and amazement. Therefore, put God first in everything. Put God ahead of everything. You know the story of Eric Little.
the phenomenal Scottish athlete who competed at the 1924 Olympics at Paris. You may have seen the movie Chariots of Fire, which was fairly accurate in rendering the historical details. Eric Liddell was favored to win the 100-meter dash at the Olympic Games, but even 1 year before the competition, he withdrew his berth because the final was to be on a Sunday, and he believed to be this day to be the day of worship, the day to worship God. And so he considered the laurel crown of Olympic gold that most athletes will only achieve once in their lifetime, if ever, he considered this a fading thing in view of his privilege to worship the living God. And so he conquered with both eyes on God, because during this year, many tried to dissuade him in every possible way, but he remained firm. And God honored this man who honored him by giving him the gold in the 400 meters, a discipline that he wasn't even favored to win, not by a long shot, and he did it in a new world record time. Well, I know that many Christians tend to be embarrassed by this example of putting God first, tend to think that Liddell took it a little too far. After all, we negotiate putting God first when much less is at stake. He should have competed. He should not have denied himself this experience of a lifetime. And I tell you something else, he should have run. And he should have run for God's name. He should have run for God's glory. But I wonder, do you know any other gold medalist from the 1924 Olympic Games? Do you? I didn't think so. How about 1928? I don't think so. It's only because he didn't run. It's only because he didn't exercise the gift that God had given him. It's only because of this tremendous sacrifice that he is remembered. And through it, a testimony is being rendered to the God that he worshiped. It's only through the sacrifice that he gave. Being at the top of his game, so to speak, at the height of his athletic career and ability, he preferred God. And decades after his death in 1945, in a Japanese prison camp, he became a missionary after his career as an athlete. His daughter Patricia was asked the one question that many had raised before. Now, would Eric Liddell have won the 100 meters if he had competed, if he had violated his own conscience? She put it this way. The gold for the 400 meters was lovely, but not the most important thing. I truly believe that had he run on Sunday and sold out his principles, he wouldn't have won. He wouldn't have had the fire. He was always running for God. Are we putting God first? Are you putting God first? It's embarrassing, isn't it, when you consider how easily we negotiate
God's worth.
The Apostle Paul sketched the Christian life as a race. He says, those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain it. God makes so much of us. How do you respond? Put him first. And the second related effect that this vision ought to have is to fill you with zeal and with resolve, a renewed commitment not only to God and to Jesus Christ, but to the bride of Christ, to the church. Even now, you should love and esteem her in a manner that reflects your appreciation of the value that she has in God's own eyes. Because this is what you see. She is important to him. She means everything to him. She shares the stage with Jesus Christ, as we have seen last week. She has the glory of God. Paul says that our bodies will be shaped like his own glorious body, Jesus Christ, that is. You can't be ambivalent about this, not if you look into this mirror. Do you see yourself? I hope and pray you do.